The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we recorded a few days ago an interview with Dr. George Friedman. Before we go to that interview, we should probably mention that there have been a number of things that have occurred in the Middle East that we will actually cover at the end of the program. You had mentioned earlier today that in the last few days, news events have gone from zero to 60 without us even really anticipating what was going to happen.
And it's interesting, Kevin, because we're talking about geopolitical issues which have a purely economic backdrop to them. And so very quickly, with an environment that was perfectly set for instability, you have both political and geopolitical issues throughout North Africa and the Middle East. And again, as you say, we'll address that as soon as we finish the interview with George Friedman.
Our guest today, David, is a return guest. He's someone who always gets us thinking. I don't know that when a person prognosticates for long-term future events, whether they themselves can even say, yeah, I'm definitely behind myself on this. But he's a man who understands strategy and positions. And like pieces on a chessboard, there's positions of power and positions of weakness. And George Friedman is who I'm talking about. The Next 100 Years was his book 2 years ago.
Kevin, that's right. 2 years ago, George Friedman crafted a piece that explored the possibilities far on the horizon, a look at the shifting sands of geostrategic relations and foreign policy, but it was over the next 100 years. And as the decades pass, and as we enter into the 22nd century, at what place will today's developed and developing powers arrive after setting their trajectory right here, right now?
Yeah, that was the question he was asking in that book. What will it look like in 100 years? Will the United States even exist, or Mexico, or, you know, what have you?
And for Friedman, America remains the dominant player. However, he does suggest and follows up in his subsequent book that there are immediate challenges that have to be met.
Well, in that subsequent book, that's what we've just recently read. We were fortunate enough, he sent us an advanced copy, The Next Decade, and I thought it was an excellent read, didn't you?
It's released for the general public on January 26th. And so you can now get a copy of that, and would encourage you to. So here in recent days, Mr. Friedman has launched what really is another ambitious exploration, but on a scale that I think many of us can better grasp, the next 10 years rather than the next 100. It's a span which he describes as directly connected to current policies and current leadership. And he emphasizes that the United States will have to crystallize its identity under strong leadership. The leadership suggested as necessary has been demonstrated by the likes of Lincoln, by the likes of FDR, and even Reagan.
Well, you know, what's interesting is, as a person looks at that, you've got Lincoln, FDR, Reagan. There's not really a partisan bent to what he's talking about. He's not talking Democrat or Republican. He's not talking liberal or conservative. He's talking about a personality type, isn't he? He's talking about somebody who's maybe willing to bend the rules in an uncomfortable way to get what may be a higher purpose accomplished.
Well, that's right. Kevin, he does say that his grave concern, and he alludes to this throughout the book, is that there's a conflict between what it will take on a pragmatic level to maintain the power and dominance that the U.S. has on the world scene today as an empire, while at the same time preserving a republic with the priorities of constitutional governance and accountability to the people. And it appears that one may have to be sacrificed, the constitutional republic, for continued world domination.
Well, and that's what I was talking about being very, very uncomfortable. When you read his book, it is very pragmatic, to use that term. I mean, it's very practical. And you sit there and you go, oh my gosh, well, what good is America as an empire, if that's really what we are, if we've lost what made us good, if we've lost what's made us free? And I know that's not his desired outcome, but he's saying, you better ponder this while we're in this position.
Well, and I think that's fair to say, Kevin. It's not a desired outcome, just one that an analyst, specifically George Friedman, is trying to come to terms with as a highly probable outcome. It's not the only challenging idea to wrestle with either in the book, Kevin. Not the first issue raised by Friedman that's uncomfortable for us to entertain. Mm. But as a reminder to our listeners, I would suggest that an idea that you haven't wrestled with, which carries with it a degree of struggle, is an idea you haven't really begun to entertain. Feeling uncomfortable is not something that should put us off. And in this book and in our conversation today, George will take us directly into the fray.
Well, you know, David, you've been telling the guys here at the office they really need to go back to Machiavelli's The Prince. It's a work that some people see as Satan's own words, okay, on holding power. And other people say, well, yeah, but it's very much realistic, you know, something written to the Medicis back 400 or 500 years ago in Italy. That was how to maintain and manage power.
As a background read, we find an unusual connection made between the American titans of political leadership, you know, Lincoln, FDR, Reagan, and a voice from the past. You've got Friedman, who revisits Renaissance Italy and listens to the whispers of none other than Niccolo Machiavelli. And as you suggest, Kevin, it's for some he's the devil, yeah, and for other he's a respected master, admittedly of a dark art, that of statecraft, you know, a trade that does not require you to roll up your sleeves to get dirty. You have, Kevin, in that period of time, political philosophy, along with most other ideas, which were being reexamined. Specifically, we're talking about the Renaissance. And many of them were being put through the grid of ancient Greek and Roman ideas, because you had these massive excavations which were occurring, and they literally dug up the classic statues and architecture of antiquity. The Italians subsequently gave new birth to the old and cherished forms of what was a bygone era. That was the era that Machiavelli lived and wrote in.
Well, and you know, that was the era that actually was the first true study of past empire, if you think about it, because this is the birth of the Renaissance. This is when libraries were opened and people were reading the classics and starting to figure out, wait a second, what did the Greeks do that the Romans didn't? Or what did the Romans do that Charlemagne didn't? You know, this was a period of time where people were actually condensing thoughts for the first time on political philosophy.
Very popular was the idea, in the Latin words, et fontes, or back to the fountainhead. And the concept at the time, during the Renaissance, Kevin, was that you had the purest thoughts the closer you got to the source of this water, if you will. If you go back to the headwaters, you don't have anything that is dirty or corrupted. And so the idea of the classics was to go back to ancient Greece and Rome and explore that. Machiavelli, in his book Discourses on Livy, expressed a keen fascination and respect for the classics. His core belief, in fact, Kevin, was in a strong and unified Italy, and frankly, constitutional republic, the one that he saw in Rome. That was his ideal. The problem was that Italy in the 15th century was nothing like it. You had the plundering Lombards, you had the excessive taxation and corruption coming from Naples and Tuscany, and it made Italy into a patchwork of very unorganized and very self-interested mini-states.
It almost sounds like the mafia today, or, you know, little Italy in New York.
Well, so what Machiavelli ends up doing in The Prince is completely setting aside his admiration of a free republic for what he considers the only means of achieving a united Italy. And the prince is that character that he believes can achieve this. He's both a monarch and, unfortunately, a despot. Mm-hmm. Now, he doesn't write it as unfortunately. That's our sort of inclusion, if you will. There is a moral cynicism, Kevin, in the prince, in Machiavelli's book, subsequent book, as the ends of unity, you know, again, of these little city-states, and of his concept of empire, justify the means of duplicity and amoral leadership. So critical to success is the prince's ability to convey a deep moral orientation for the state, while at the same time obscuring the less than moral means of achieving the stated objective.
So what he's saying is it's okay to lie to achieve a good end, and if you're a statesman.
Well, so with unique insight and clarity, Friedman brings Lincoln, FDR, and Reagan as the cast of characters that have filled these shoes in recent times. And he goes further, Kevin, to assume that the possibility of maintaining the American empire, even if it was accidentally achieved, will require a similar type of character, one that pursues the good of the empire which, similar to Machiavelli, is the security and welfare of the state, while employing any means necessary.
Well, you know, David, another place that made me uncomfortable about this book, because hopefully we are looking at things from a moral, ethical way, and in a way, both with Machiavelli's The Prince and in his analysis both in The Next Decade, and frankly, even in his book a couple of years ago, The Next 100 Years, he's looking very cold strategically as to what is the best move. Now, one of the things that he brings out in the book is we have a blindness. There's a blindness in America. Maybe it's a youthful, idealistic blindness about really how much strength we exert worldwide. And in that blindness, we can create a tremendous amount of damage, unintended maybe, but a tremendous amount of damage by not admitting the strength that we have and not administering it in a way that's more strategic, more planned. And, you know, you were just recently talking about Milton's poem about Samson, you know, his incredible strength, but he was operating in blindness.
Samson's Agonistes, he says this, "To me," this is Samson speaking as the character, "to me strength is my bane, and proves the source of all my miseries, so many and so huge that each apart would ask a life to wail, but chief of all, O loss of sight, of thee I most complain, blind among enemies, oh, worse than chains, dungeon, or beggary, or decrepit age." And if you think of the American Empire, Kevin, as a great Samson, as a Colossus, what you have is someone who is blind, certainly, and we'll discuss that a little bit today, both in terms of tactical versus strategic thinking, and how have we gotten ourselves into this? Strength is, in fact, our bane. We'll come back to this quote in a little while, but it frames several of our discussion points today, because I think it points to whether or not America has the stomach for being an empire. The issue is this, recalling Milton's quote, "Are we blind? Is strength our bane? You know, we have influence that's unparalleled," to quote Harold Lasky, a political theorist and economist who died in 1950. "America would soon bestride the world like a colossus. Neither Rome at the height of its power nor Great Britain in the period of its economic supremacy enjoyed an influence so direct, so profound, so pervasive." And certainly that's grown from 1950 to this day. George, thank you for joining us. You've described the U.S. as an unintended empire. Maybe you could explain that.
Well, when we think of Napoleon or Hitler, they set out to create empire. They also failed. When you think of Rome and Britain, that's not what they set out to do. They set out to make a living in the world. And in the process of doing well, they accumulated more power than they expected. Certainly they stumbled at the beginning, and then they built the institutions that had to be built in order to manage what they had for the time they had it. So there are two types of imperialist. The Hitlers and the Napoleons don't do very well. And the Britons and the Romans do, and we are at the beginning where the British were, say, in the early 19th century, late 18th century, and that was a time when they were defeated by insurgents in North America and humiliated. In 1825, it was the time of one of the most colossal financial crises over Latin American bonds that led to a significant depression in Britain. And those are the things they learned from and learned to build institutions from. And that's where I think we are.
Now, I'd say that the constitution of the British during that period may be a little different than the American constitution today. We, in America, have a culture that is self-consciously anti-imperialist. How do we proceed in great power when the cost to do so is unpopular and the populace does maintain a vote?
One of the important things to understand is it is what it is. The United States produces one quarter of the world's wealth every year. It controls the world's oceans. It has troops in 27 different countries. I suppose you could withdraw the troops, but I doubt very much that the American public would enjoy a massive diminution of relative economic power. Producing 5% of the world's wealth is not particularly pleasant. I certainly don't think they want to give up the control of the oceans. Things go both ways there. So, I mean, one of the really profound issues that the United States faces is the tension between its founding and the reality which not only was created, was thrust on it, and the need of the American public to reach a level of maturity that it doesn't yet have. At the heart of the American dilemma is that we are in a situation where we can't really back out from the power we have. And there's a great deal of wishful thinking that we can and still have the benefits we enjoy. We can have our cake and eat it too. And that really is the crisis to me of the next decade. At the heart of it is the question of whether the American public can mature enough to save the republic. I have no doubt that America as a country will be the dominant power of the next century. I am not convinced that the republic will survive in the face of it.
And that's the crux, is to maintain the imperial role that we play, even if by accident, as you describe both the Roman, British, and American predicaments as empires. The question is, can we remain a constitutional republic in that context over the next 10, 20, 30 years?
And that is a terrific problem, and it's made all the more difficult that institutionally we aren't prepared for the role we're playing in the world, and we're not even prepared to be honest about the role we're playing. We have a institutionally structured in foreign policy that was born in the Second World War, matured in the Cold War, with 16 intelligence agencies, with a State Department that is not always the most effective that you'd like to find, with a Defense Department with its own foreign policy, and a presidency that's overwhelmed in managing these things. One of the things that happens is we stumble into unfortunate circumstances, overextending ourselves, and this massive bureaucracy then impinges on individual rights, not because the people are willfully seeking power like madmen. It's just you have this hugely disorganized structure exercising tremendous power that becomes beyond the power of even the president to control. So we really have to have a transformation in the way this works, but we can't have a transformation while we lie to ourselves and say to ourselves, well, once the war in Iraq is over, it's all going to be okay. We will be engaged in the world for a very long time, and it's not going to stop.
There's a middle ground that you describe between idealism and realism in our foreign policy. What would that look like in practice?
Well, you have to think about a particular person like Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln was a deep idealist. He hated slavery with his soul, as he showed in the 1858 Great Debates. He ran for president lying about his position on slavery. As head of the United States, he violated the Constitution, for example, arresting the Maryland legislature to keep them from seceding.
Suspending habeas corpus.
He also allied with his enemies. He once said, I hope God is on our side, but I must have Kentucky, a slaveholding state. He did these things very realistically in order to preserve his moral standing. This is the real dilemma. There is no morality without power. It's merely sentiment. And if you're going to have morality, you have to be prepared to exercise power. And the exercise of power will cause you to do things that seem incompatible with that morality. Roosevelt had the same problem. Ronald Reagan had the same problem. We Americans like to think in terms of moral sentiment. This is what I think is right, therefore that's what should be. Lincoln, Roosevelt, Reagan all understood they had to be much craftier than that. And honesty and even the Constitution sometimes came after these things. In an odd way, Lincoln and Roosevelt violated the Constitution in order to save it.
Now, in your view, there has been and will continue to be a significant strengthening of the state globally, not just in the United States, largely as a response to the financial crisis. In fact, you describe the most significant consequence of the 2008 financial collapse as being geopolitical and political, not economic. Maybe you could explore that a bit.
Well, when we take a look at what really happened, I mean, we see the European Union, for example, reexamining its basic geopolitical foundations in the face of the crisis. We see the Chinese staggered by the rising American savings rate, much of which comes out of their hide. And in the United States, we see a periodic readjustment of what we mean by the corporation. You know, it's interesting. People talk about the free market. Well, the foundation of the free market is the corporation, which says something extraordinary, that it is possible to own all or part of a company, but not be liable for its debts. In a true free market, that would be unthinkable. Ownership and liability would go hand in hand. The way we've created the corporation, it separates the two, and it's a very good thing because it makes the modern markets possible. But this is a complete artifice of the state. The state invented the corporation. The state decided what the risks and liabilities should be and how they should be assigned. And the state periodically adjusts them depending on the circumstances, sometimes one way, sometimes the other way. And we've been engaged in this for a very long time. Modern economic life is built around the corporation, from a house painter to the largest company. But this is a political event. These corporations derive from political decisions, are implemented by the state, and there's nothing natural about corporate law, for God's sakes. It varies differently. So what this crisis did was, well, we had a periodic financial crisis. We had the third world debt crisis. We had the savings and loan crisis. And they will have about the same models, which is to say investors go to an extreme. Institutions start to fail. Their failure would undermine the nation. The state goes in and bails them out, does a readjustment of the economy, and then the financial community proclaims how stupid the government is for not being better at handling things so they can make money. A very long and very funny process in many ways.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
Coming back to the issue of leadership, you've contrasted tactical decision-making made by both the present and former presidents here in the U.S. with that of strategic decision-making, which is both needed and currently absent. What does strategic decision-making look like for the U.S. over the next decade?
Well, in the first place, recognizing the permanence of the American presence in the world. I have a lot of admiration for Ron Paul, but when he says, you know, we're stopped tampering the world, he doesn't also say, and let's take the hit in terms of our national wealth. The second thing it has to be is, how do we handle the world? To me, the balance of power is to international relations what the Bill of Rights is to domestic politics. It is the foundation of how an empire that's mature handles itself. And an example being that Iran and Iraq, Saddam Hussein and the Ayatollahs, balanced themselves off very nicely, very bloodily. They fought a war in the 1980s, causing millions of casualties. Maintaining that balance of power made a great deal of sense from the American point of view. Invading Iraq upset that balance of power and represented very bad strategy. And this is what a balance of power means. The British didn't occupy India by sending in an army of 2 million. It hardly had any soldiers there. It had soldiers and some diplomats, and it basically used the internal tensions of India to govern it because many of those in India wanted them there and benefited from it. So it's sort of a jujitsu that you constantly are carrying out, and it requires a very sophisticated and careful management of the relations. So Iraq is sort of an example of how not to. And watching the British in India or the Romans in Egypt is an example of how to do it.
So whether it was the Iraqi-Iranian balance of power, the Indian-Pakistani, or the Arab-Israeli balance of power, there's several things that in the context of the last 2, 5, 10 years, even if you wanted to go back to 1991, to the 03 period prior to our engagement in Iraq, we've seen a shifting in the balance of power. Is it possible to regain it, or are we talking about a reconfiguration? And maybe you could start with looking at what that reconfiguration might look like in the Middle East. Of course, there's a number of questions I have for you on Europe as well.
Sure. Well, the first thing is to understand that the United States has global interests, and no one region can supersede all others. The war on terror has thrown us off balance. Very reasonably, in the first few years, we became obsessed with Al-Qaeda and the Middle East because we simply didn't understand what the threat was. But as we've reached a point of understanding two facts, the threat is limited but can't be abolished, as we saw in Moscow recently, we will have terrorist attacks. And protecting against terrorism is one of the things you do, but it can't be the only thing you do. The United States right now is all in the Middle East. We have no ground forces for anyplace else. It's our entire bandwidth is there. In that region, there are three balances of power, the Arab-Israeli, the Iran-Iraqi, and the Indo-Pakistani. In Afghanistan, we are weakening the Pakistanis because we want them to fight alongside us, if you will, in Afghanistan, do what they need to do. And in so doing, we threaten to destabilize the state and thereby give India inordinate power in the region. We have to ask the question, is anything in Afghanistan worth destabilizing the Indian subcontinent? In the Arab-Israeli dispute, the Israelis are now overwhelmingly powerful. They are defining the region as they want to. The United States is listened to relatively little in this relationship. So the question is, how do we create a balance of power that has clearly slipped against a country that is fundamentally aligned with the United States, but the relationship has to be tweaked? But the most important question we have is this. Iran is the largest conventional military force in the Persian Gulf. Nuclear power has nothing to do with it. They're simply the most powerful. We're withdrawing from Iraq. That means that the Iranians will fill the vacuum in Iraq one way or the other. And they will become the dominant power in the Arabian Peninsula as well. They don't have to invade. The Saudis know how to read the situation and will accommodate themselves. These are situations where we have to correct the situation. In the case of Iran, we have two choices, a massive bombing campaign against their conventional forces. It has the virtue, if it works, of solving the problem. It has the vice, if it fails, of really having some angry Iranians coming at us. The other alternative is to do what Roosevelt did with Stalin and Nixon did with Mao Zedong, both homicidal maniacs, quite crazed. Deal with the Iranians. Cut a deal. Stabilize the situation if we can, and wait for the Turks to become more powerful and take over because they have to. In each case, you have a temporary solution. Americans hate temporary solutions. They want a solution to the Arab-Israeli problem. They want a solution to Al-Qaeda and stuff. And that's not the way the world works. What you have is a series of temporary tweaks, hopefully small ones, that are constantly keeping the system in balance. What the United States, however, is doing right now is massive over-interventions that destabilize the issue, create a larger problem before, because we're really not very sophisticated in how we work in the world.
While we're fond of permanent solutions, not particularly keen on temporary solutions, it seems ironically that we're stuck in these millisecond judgments and have an inability to plan out a grand strategy, which would include several step sequences, not unlike a chess game. It seems that's where we're perhaps off balance ourselves in terms of engaging these world powers in a strategic way with a grand strategy in mind. How does the American leadership extend its time horizon and begin thinking in terms of a grand strategy?
Well, the first thing to remember is the United States didn't become this unintended empire until December 31st, 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed and the last European power that was a global power disappeared. We've been at this for only 20 years, which from the standpoint of history is not much at all. What we have to do in the first instance is come to terms with the permanence of our situation. So long as in our mind we have the World War I mentality, we're going to go take care of this problem and go home, or the World War II mentality, well, now the war is over, or the Soviet Union has collapsed and we don't have to worry about anything. So long as we constantly believe that we've reached some extraordinary point where international affairs and war and danger are no longer relevant, we can't have a long-term policy. Even now, there's a kind of feeling that somehow we are going to defeat Islamic terrorism. Well, we may mitigate it. We're not going to defeat it. And as we reach a political judgment that these things go on for a very long time, that is our permanent condition, then we can start thinking about the question of how to manage it in the long term. So long as we fantasize that we don't need to do that or that everything will be over very soon, we can't do that. And I think the fundamental problem is the American public. The American public loves to blame politicians or bankers, whoever. But the problem is that the American public is psychologically unprepared for the burdens of empire. They're perfectly prepared for the benefits of empire, and they like it. They just don't want to pay the price. They think they can have the cake and eat it too, as I said before. The thing we really have to look for here is a maturation of the public, and that's a kind of a dialectic relationship between the public and the political leadership. You need to have a leader, particularly a president, who matures the public. I mean, the way that FDR matured the public from believing that the war in Europe, for example, was not our war when he knew full well it would be, and brought them systematically along to understand that. Now, this is a greater challenge, but, I mean, one of the ways not to do it is to believe that the greatest crisis we're facing in our history is 10% unemployment. It's not the greatest crisis. It's not even number one. It's an unpleasant thing. But so long, you know, as somebody puts on the wall something saying, it's the economy, stupid, he's got it exactly right. That's stupid. The economy will manage itself. It's the enemies outside our borders that are dangerous.
Well, let's look at Europe briefly, because as you've said, in the last few years or decade, we've dedicated all of our bandwidth to the Middle East, and that has created its own imbalances within Europe. You've got, on the one hand, a collection of states with a shared currency, but with distinct national interests. And perhaps we'll see a return to some level of conflict in Europe as those strains are played out, both of a financial and political nature. But in the absence of U.S. interest in Europe, dedicated interest, Germany and Russia have developed a bit of a connection, if you will. And this is interesting because it's part and parcel to the reemergence of Russia, the connection with Germany and directly to Europe. Russia has been, in essence, reborn. Perhaps you'd like to address that.
Well, the 1990s were a fantasy time. And one of the fantasies was that Russia was finished, it would never reemerge. A newer fantasy is that Russia has a declining population, therefore can't be a great power. Russia has always been an economic basket case for the past 200 years. Its military and political power has far outstripped what other nations could do. And Russia has certainly reemerged. In the meantime, Germany is reexamining its relationship to the European Union. The European Union was an institution superbly suited for prosperity. It unfortunately was not well designed for a crisis. And at the root of it was a contradiction. Developing countries need to run positive balances of trade. They have to take advantage of their low wages in order to build up their economy by exporting. The European Union is built around Germany, which is the world's second largest exporter. And in these relationships, the Germans simply overwhelm the development capability of these other countries who wind up with negative balance of payments with them. The United States, in the 1950s, strengthened Germany and Japan by allowing them to protect their markets while giving them free access to the American market. There was political reasons for that. It worked. But if the United States did what Germany does to the rest of Europe in 1950s, neither Germany or Japan would have emerged. The contradiction built into the EU emerged during the economic crisis. Two things happened. The first that happened was that countries like Ireland and Greece realized that their national sovereignty that they bled for was very much in danger. And the Germans realized they don't really want to pay for the Greeks. They certainly want to flood the Greek market with German goods, but they don't want to live with the consequences. So the Germans are looking beyond Europe, and they have a relationship with Russia. I mean, in the first place, they're dependent on Russia for energy imports. That's absolutely critical to the Germans. Second, the Germans are having a population shortage. They don't want to bring in any more Turkish workers for obvious reasons. And when you can't bring in any more workers, you move your factories to where the workers are. Russia, in spite of its declining population, still has surplus labor because of the way their economy is structured. German factories are moving into Russia. The Russians badly need technology. So there's a synergy between them, added to the fact that neither of them like the world the United States is running and would like to form a coalition to block the United States. So you're seeing the emergence of a German-Russian relationship based on mutual interest on all levels. And I think that's going to very much be a key figure, a key element of the next decade. Of course, caught between them are the Poles in the worst place possible.
Well, George, thank you for joining us today. We look forward to future conversations. We've enjoyed conversations with your colleagues, Cameron Bakari, specifically on Turkey, and look forward to your analysis from Stratfor whenever it's released. Appreciate the next decade and your review of what we can anticipate in terms of international relations and strategy. Appreciate it greatly.
I enjoy your show always. Thank you.
David, as always, the time went much quicker than we thought it would. The questions that you had, I know we didn't get through probably half of them, but the book itself does answer questions. I know one of the questions that I wanted to hear him elaborate on, but we just didn't have time in this show, is the fiscal problems that we have right now in this country and where that leads us with his thinking strategically worldwide.
I think, Kevin, one of his assumptions is that there is, given the degree of power that America has today, there is a permanence to our empire. It's not going to be easily upset, and that power structure is not easily going to be taken away or toppled. And I would suggest that there are feet of clay in our particular empire in the form of fiscal imbalances and fiscal problems. We have Medicare and Social Security, which are promises that, if kept, will force us to devalue our denarius, if you want the historical analogy, or dollar today, if you prefer. But, you know, how do we proceed without restructuring our liabilities and without declaring bankruptcy?
Well, could it possibly be this planned devaluation of the dollar, the planned default, actually, through this inflation rate that we talked about, you know, with Ian McAvity last week?
Kevin, you're right. If there is a concerted effort to devalue not only our currency, but the yen, the British pound, the euro, yes, you do relieve some of those fiscal imbalances. The problem is you're creating monetary imbalances in the same stroke and in potentially creating other issues that then have to be addressed. Kevin, as we wrap up, one of the interesting parallel ideas when you look at the naval supremacy that the U.S. has today, and that being, in Friedman's view, one of the significant things that gives us an advantage, something that we cannot allow to lose. We have to maintain that and maybe even increase that advantage over time. But we also have the advantage of being the world's reserve currency. And there is, you know, something that we've begun to talk about in the office, a new geography of fiat, wherein the control that we have is not only military, but is by our currency denomination as well. We wield a great degree of control around the world, given the amount of trade that we bring to the table, but also the influence that we have via the underlying denomination, the currency itself.
Well, and I think, David, these interviews are valuable in that, you know, we look at our picture here in America of the devaluation of the dollar. We see the unemployment rate as high as it is. We see these dark days as possibly not having another side. But in reality, if you look at Rome, as they inflated their currency and as they went through their incredible financial and economic problems of, you know, the several hundred years after Christ, it did take a long, long time for that empire to ultimately fail.
And of note, Kevin, is the number of booms and busts that took place over that 400-year span.
Right.
We're talking about a normal business cycle that has been a part of every culture, every society, every empire, and it would be an interesting coincidence if it was this particular bust that marked the end of our empire. Friedman argues that's not the case, and it's worthy of consideration. His book is certainly worthy of reading and studying.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, George Friedman. His book that we were talking about today is called The Next Decade, and it's just hitting the shelves at this point. Give us a call if you have any questions, 800-525-9556, and you can always look us up on the Internet at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com.
Kevin, we recorded that program just a few days ago, and it was literally hours before the events occurred in Tunisia and Egypt, and have now been issues spreading to Syria, Jordan, Sudan, and Yemen. Kevin, it's interesting how quickly things have deteriorated in the Middle East and in North Africa, and we want to give some comment to that as an important conclusion to the interview with George Friedman.
Well, you know, and David, it's fascinating to me as the years have gone by, the last 3 years as we've been doing this program, that we've talked about the financial, moving to the economic, moving to the political, moving to the geopolitical. And one of the things that you've really focused on is inflation, as strange as it may sound, tying that into geopolitics and how the power of countries are maneuvered. Inflation really does boil down to the cost of a bowl of rice or a bowl of wheat. And the people, the demonstrators right now in Egypt, may not really know what outcome they're looking for. They may be even being motivated from behind the scenes. But really, what's motivating them, not only in Egypt, but in Tunisia and some of these other countries, is their stomach and the gas tank.
Kevin, for 29 years, Mubarak has been in power.
Right.
And for 29 years, people have griped about someone that they didn't particularly like, but
right.
someone that they couldn't necessarily oust either. He came from the military. He had military ties. That was the source of his power and his connectedness coming into power. Now, the question is, what have people done during that period of time? Absolutely nothing.
Right.
What is the flashpoint? What brings this front and center today is set by what we just suggested a few minutes ago in the discussion with Friedman. There's fiscal imbalances in the developed world which are being met. We've exhausted all of our fiscal solutions, if you will, and have now leaned heavily on the monetary side of the equation.
Right.
We are, in fact, printing money through quantitative easing one and two, and this is being done not just in the U.S. by the Federal Reserve, but other central banks around the world.
Well, and for us, David, it devalues the dollar. For people in poorer countries, it makes them hungry.
But this is the issue, Kevin. When we talk about a geography of fiat, we are the world's reserve currency.
Right.
And we are exporting that inflation. We're forcing the issue wherein if we devalue our currency, we force other central banks to do the same to maintain a relatively stable comparative value to the U.S. dollar. What does that do? Well, it's a great equalizer in terms of the money. But it's not the great equalizer. It's the great problem creator in terms of what it does to real things. And in this, we're talking about specifically wheat. It's an unfortunate confluence of events where the U.S. is sorting out its own financial problems, creating and exporting inflation. And at the same time, the average person in Egypt who's living on $2 a day is forced to reckon with the unintended consequences of our inflationary exports.
Well, and speaking of unintended consequences, you had mentioned wheat, which I believe you had said in the past that that's Egypt's major staple. Okay, but rice is a major staple in other parts of the world. So what's going on in Egypt with wheat also affected the rice market. Didn't you say yesterday that the rice market was up limit?
That's right. And this is the main issue, Kevin, because it's not just that we have inflation. We certainly have monetary inflation, and we have it globally.
Right.
But then, with that as the context, you have something like floods in Australia or bad weather patterns in Russia. And just a few months ago, the Russians quit exporting wheat. And then on top of that, you have a bad crop in Australia because of the flooding. So, Kevin, you have this inflationary backdrop, and then just a few other pieces of the puzzle have to be put in place for it to become a tinderbox. In this case, it's the Middle East, and it can just as easily be. And what I would suggest is, while this may have a resolution, whether it is a change in politics or a significant crackdown from the existing regime in power, what is interesting to me is that the context remains the same, that of an underlying inflation globally. Mm. And all it takes, in this case, is, let's say, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, for social unrest to rise there. Instead of wheat, it's rice or some other critical commodity. In Latin America, it would be corn more than any other. So you have, Kevin, an emerging market vulnerability. And so while people are beating the drums and suggesting that the future is in the emerging markets and not in the developed world, what I would suggest is that the vulnerabilities are significant there, and the political upsets, literally, within, as you said just earlier, 0 to 60, Kevin. We've gone from 0 to 60 in a matter of days. We spoke with one of the preeminent, just a few days ago, preeminent geopolitical analysts in the United States,
right,
Kevin, and this was not on his radar. This was not on anyone's radar. And overnight, we have issues that could very well jeopardize even the standing of the Saudi family.
You know, it's an amazing thing, too, David. Talk about flashpoints. Not only did it happen quickly, but when dominoes start falling of this stature, I mean, your encouragement would be not just to look at Egypt and however they solve this. This is one domino falling to another, to another, to another. A lot of people don't realize Egypt is one of the major stabilizing factors to keep Israel from actually being threatened as a nation.
Well, that's right, Kevin. I mean, they've been able to take advantage of the significant cushion, which is the Sinai Peninsula, and a peace agreement entered into by Menachem Begin, by the way, under the advice and guidance of one of our former guests, Yehuda Avner,
right,
who was one of his chief counsels at the time. And, Kevin, this is really interesting because it changes the support structure that we have in the Middle East through Israel, because they now have what is, in essence, an existential threat. They have had different threats over the years, which have caused them to lose ground strategically. But once again, this is the first time since the early 70s that they have faced a truly existential threat. You could argue that Iran and nuclear weapons and things of this nature, those are your outlying events, those outliers, if you will. Those are your unlikely events, which are real issues, but still, in terms of probability, low probability. The dynamics change radically if Jordan moves to a different position politically,
right,
if Egypt moves to a different position politically. It is a major destabilizer, because what you have in the backdrop behind Mohammed al-Baradei is the Muslim Brotherhood, who from 1928 has had one goal in mind. Though they've executed it through many social programs, which are admirable, they have had one singular mission, Kevin, and that is reestablishment of the caliphate and the implementation of Sharia law over all previously Muslim-controlled lands. That takes us back to the 8th to 12th century, Kevin, in terms of what they see as an ideal world. Now, you turn Egypt into a center of Islamic extremism, and Kevin, although this is the Sunni version, very different than the Shia version in Iran, this is something that has to change the U.S. political calculus, geopolitical calculus. And it causes us to pause and ask if, in fact, the U.S. State Department isn't revamping all of their strategies. Why, just in recent days, has Hillary Clinton called 260 foreign ambassadors back to the United States to meet this week in closed-door meetings? It's unprecedented. We've never done that before. Not in any point in U.S. history, even during World War I and World War II. We have everyone back in one room discussing where we go from here on an international basis.
You know, it blows my mind, David, when we think of geostrategic types of things, I think of carrier groups, and I think of standing armies, or I think of missiles and airplanes. But it reminds me of the old story, you lose the kingdom for want of a nail, you know, for the price of rice. Or for the price of wheat, we lose this stability that George Friedman has talked about many times. What a critical balance that has to be maintained.
Well, it is fascinating, Kevin, because you look at the establishment of Mubarak back in the 70s, and this for 29, almost 30 years, has been a deeply entrenched power structure, not only in the Middle East, but specifically in Egypt. And in just a matter of days, that can be called into question. Whether or not Mubarak is pushed out of power, that remains to be seen. But the fact that in just a few short days, something as simple as wheat and an existing prejudice can upset an entire kingdom, that's impressive. That's impressive. And I think goes to prove our point, Kevin, that the context is critical. The context of a financial crisis, which has led to tremendous amount of fiscal instability and monetary abuse, now has set the stage for politicians and geostrategic thinkers to be making either right moves or wrong moves, which truly jeopardize stability and globalization. Are we in a period of deglobalization, as we've suggested and talked about in times past? It looks as if that is, in fact, the case, Kevin.
Well, once again, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.